Well, while we're waiting for a few more family members to arrive, maybe I'll play another one on the list. Ted was a harmonica player, and I always loved having Ted in the congregation because I could shout things out to Ted, and he would always respond with some just appropriately hilarious quip. I'll dedicate this little funky rhythm to Ted tonight.
We gather this morning to mourn the death and celebrate the life of Theodore J. Vanida. As family, as friends, as neighbors, as colleagues, as members of the many different circles of Ted's life, we are brought together by the spirit of this remarkable man. It is a very moving testimony to the truth that Ted's life was well lived with integrity, with love and respect, that we are all here with our memories, our stories, and our knowing that life has been so much richer, so much more joyful, so much more fulfilling because of our beloved companion and friend, Ted. This morning, in this time of remembrance and celebration, we are also here to do some of life's most difficult spiritual work. The loss of a loved one is a mysterious and challenging time. Even though Ted lived a long, accomplished, and inspiring life, we still struggle with unsaid goodbyes and the unfinished business of love, left with an empty place in our hearts for him that no one else can ever fill. We are also asked to confront the reality of death, to face the truth of our own mortality, and to acknowledge that life is a short, fragile, and sometimes painful journey. Yet we can find strength in the knowledge that we need not do this work alone. We are held in the embrace of Ted's love for each of us and the bond of love that is the very heart of life itself. Held by this love, let us find comfort in the company of one another as we share our grief and our love. Let us offer each other friendly faces and share warm embraces, memories, gentle tears, and moments of laughter as we affirm the truth of John Lovejoy Elliott's words. The love of the human heart is the most real and the most beautiful of all the realities we know. It is the richest gift of all of our humanity. It is love that joins us together as families, friends, neighbors, and religious communities. Whatever the length of time may be, to have known something of this is to have experienced the supreme privilege of being human. The anguish of parting cannot destroy this most real of all realities. The love has been. The affection has existed. The ties have been woven. Life has been shared, the joys and the sorrows. This has been as real and strong as anything in life. Bound by this love which brings us together, let us take this time to name our shared loss, to express our sorrow in the company of those who share it, to celebrate and remember a life well lived, and to affirm the value of life, not so much by its length as by its meaning, to acknowledge love, accomplishment, and dignity, and to enshrine in our memories and hearts the best of what we have learned from him. Here and now, let us bear witness to the memory of Theodore J. Vanita, husband, father, father-in-law, grandfather, friend, teacher, wise counselor, social justice warrior, who now in death bequeaths a part precious and beloved, which will be with us in truth and beauty, in dignity and courage and love to the end of our days. In this spirit, welcome to all of you. I'm the Reverend Stephen Protzman. I serve as the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent, where Ted was a member and a leader among us for 27 years. This morning, we will remember and celebrate Ted's life through readings and memories, stories and music, as we honor the meaning that he has had and continues to have for all of us who care for him. During our service, there will be an opportunity to share some remembrances or stories about Ted, so I invite you to think about something you might want to say to help us all know and appreciate more deeply who Ted is and how he has touched our lives. On behalf of Ted's family, thank you for being here this morning to offer the gifts of your presence and support.
And in just a moment, actually, I'll be inviting you to stand again. I wish Ted was here. He would be cracking a joke about me right now. Unitarian Universalists light a flame within a chalice to unite us in our worship, to symbolize our ongoing search for the light of truth, and to reflect our connections with one another and all of creation. In this hour of remembrance, we light this fire to affirm our belief in the power and possibilities of life and love, and as a symbol of the strength and support we find in this gathered community. And we have Ted's granddaughter, Allison Vanita, here to light our chalice. And we have a reading in the words in your order of service for the chalice lighting. So I invite you to stand for those and to remain standing for the hymn of for the hymn following that. Let's read together. We come together to remind ourselves to treat all people kindly because they are our brothers and sisters, to take good care of the earth, because it is our home, to live lives full of goodness and love, because that is how we will make our world the best place it can be. Our first reading today, Do Not Stand at My Grave by Joyce Fossen. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am a thousand winds that blow. I am the diamond glint on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you wake in the morning hush, I am the swift, uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I am the soft starlight at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. Our second reading, There Will Come a Day by Lou Sarrett. Deep wet moss and cool blue shadows beneath a bending fir, and the purple solitude of mountains when only the dark owls stir. Oh, there will come a day, a twilight, when I shall sink to rest in deep wet moss and cool blue shadows upon a mountain's breast, and yield a body torn with passions and bruised with earthly scars to the cool oblivion of evening, of solitude and stars. Our third reading, I Planted a Seed by Robert Weston. I planted a ripe seed and it split, and where it had been, a green sprout appeared, but the seed disintegrated. The green sprout grew, a thing of beauty, sent down roots, sent out leaves, budded, flowered, bore fruit, decayed, and was itself a withered thing. I could not even keep the ripe seed. Each in its time had its own peculiar beauty. All things change, nothing remains the same. So, each in its time, each life in its every moment, the baby, the child, the youth, the lover, the parent, the aged, is at its ultimate state in each moment and passes on. Pluck this moment as you would a precious flower. Share it as if it were love and let it go. Beauty and wonder lie all about you even now. They too, even as you, are never final, but always in process of being and becoming. Take then each moment as the perfect gift of life, knowing that you shall no more be able to hold it as it is than what is already past. Even as you let go, another and yet different moment comes.
Some
Jonathan Harris says that no matter what you do in your life, what you create, what career you have, your greatest creation is always going to be your life story. It is through these stories, these reminders of how Ted has been a part of our lives, that he will live on. And we will remember everything that was true, good, funny, and inspiring in his life. It is also good for us to speak of these qualities which we treasured in Ted, for by speaking of them, they become vital and enduring and grow into us, so that we take on what was noble and become more noble ourselves. We'll begin our reflections on Ted's life with stories and memories from some of his colleagues.
So I'm Jeff Wenstrup, and I'm honored to talk about Ted's contributions to the Northeast Ohio Medical University, that is NeoMed. Now, I have a few notes with me. And I know Ted. Ted would be saying, "Wenstrup, why do you have notes? Don't you know what you want to say?" And I'd have to say to Ted, "Yes, I know what I want to say." And I know, like you, Ted, I know the difference between winging it and using the right words. And this is one of those times, I think, for the right words. So together with several others present today, I'm one of the faculty and staff that Ted hired. And accepting myself, he did a really good job of that. So be that as it may, he did hire me, and I serve in the role of chair of the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology, the successor of the Department of Neurobiology that Ted founded. So I'm both a successor and a beneficiary of Ted. Let me explain. So NeoMed was founded in the mid-1970s as Northeastern Ohio University's College of Medicine, or NeoUCOM. Ted was among the first faculty hired in the new medical school. It will not come as a surprise to many of you to know that Ted placed two strong conditions on his hiring. One of those was that the new school would have to accept Ted's political activism. In the 1970s, Ted was very active in action against the Vietnam War and against the environmental impact of strip mining in Ohio. His second condition grew out of his long-standing and deep professional interest in studies of the brain. Right? At the time, neurobiology, or neuroscience, was coming into his own as an academic discipline. And Ted was conducting fundamental research in the brain circuitry responsible for learned movement. Right? He wanted to make sure that NeoUCOM was on the forefront of scientific study of the brain, and the forefront of educating medical students in the brain sciences. Well, NeoUCOM accepted both of those conditions. He continued his social and political activism up until the time of his death. And he formed one of the first departments of neurobiology in the United States. So political activism and neurobiology were two fundamental and enduring aspects. But perhaps even stronger feature of Ted's professional life was his absolute unbridled passion for teaching. Ted absolutely loved to teach. Right? He loved lecturing. He loved working with students in the teaching labs. He loved the one-on-one interaction of mentoring students. He developed new methodologies and new modalities to teach about the brain sciences. He and his faculty and his staff developed one of the first digital resources for educating students about the brain, the workings of the brain. All right, and he loved to sing, and you'll hear, I believe, shortly about how he used song in order to teach about the brain. So when it came to teaching, Ted loved it all. So Ted's love and skill at teaching were well recognized. He was awarded the Outstanding Teacher Award by the medical students, and the school recognized him as one of the first members of the Master's Teachers Guild shortly before he retired. Even now, we recognize outstanding achievement in the neurosciences, among medical students by the Ted Vanita Award in neuroscience. So Ted continued teaching even after he retired, but I think the longer-lasting impact of his love of teaching was the dedication to teaching of the people he hired. I felt that, and as I gave my first lectures to the medical students under Ted's watchful eyes and demanding eyes, I might add. And I am proud to say that that dedication continues among the faculty in the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology and elsewhere at NeoMed. So Ted made several contributions to NeoUCOM as it formed a new school of medicine. To its overall curriculum, to the hiring of many highly qualified faculty and staff, to the high quality of neuroscience research, and especially to his gift of teaching. So thank you, Ted. We at NeoMed are deeply grateful for your contributions, grateful for all of your efforts.
Good morning. For those of you that I've not had the pleasure of meeting yet, I'm Bo Chopko. I'm Ted's final PhD student in the neurosciences, and we had a friendship going back 36 years. Swanee so graciously invited me onto the program to represent the students and what education meant to all of us who were under the graces to have intersected our lives with Ted. As I reflected upon this eventual day, I tried to avoid the inevitable sadness. We all saw it coming, like headlights approaching from the distance, across perhaps a prairie or a mountain pass. No dodging that approaching train, but so it goes, as Kurt Vonnegut once wrote. But what is truly inevitable and remarkable about Ted's life is that he touched so many people and left each of them with an educational gift beyond valuation. This is what I focus on. This is what gets me through. Ted was many, many things, too numerous to list. A tapestry, a multifaceted gem. His life as an educator, however, was without equal. I met Ted, like many, through the educational system. I was a mere undergraduate pre-med student when he came to lecture to our medical sociology course one fine day, a day that would ultimately change my life by setting me on a path. He captivated and enthralled like no professor ever could. When I finally experienced his course, Functional Neuroanatomy, as a freshman medical student, the hook was set for a life career in neurosciences. In fact, if it wasn't for Ted, I never would have become a neurosurgeon. And I'm grateful for that every day. Innovation and creativity, such were the essential elements of Ted's style. He taught a fiendishly difficult topic, neuroanatomy. I'm not going to say he made it easy, you can't, but remade it human and humane. In an era that would seem downright prehistoric today, no internet, no Bluetooth, video on 3/4-inch tapes, and when a laser pointer was the ultimate of high tech. And laser pointers were also the size of like a baton back then too, for those of us who lived through that era. He would develop these multimedia extravaganzas by which to teach us. My favorite was his ability to run three slide projectors simultaneously so as to trace anatomical pathways through the brains in three perspectives. It was pretty amazing. And Sharon, who lived through all this with us, is nodding her head because she often had to help him get all those slide projectors together and make sure the bulbs didn't burn out or that the carousels actually worked. So it was really, really quite an effort. You could only watch slack-jawed in awe. But he went through all of this effort for one goal, to make us better doctors and researchers and to help our fellow man. This, however, was accomplished with a steady underpinning of humor. the grease of Ted's skids, the fuel for his engine. And my, what a wellspring of humor he was. Ted had the conscious, volitional humor of every comedian. And I could always tell that rare transition into serious ground, the blink eyelid closure accompanied by a slight extension of the head and a tilting back. But this was pretty rare, I must say, because humor was his default mode. Ted had many personas, like the expert comedian he was, Groucho Marx, Mark Twain, the Mandarin academic ivory tower elite to whom he poked fun at mercilessly, the rebel fringe motorcyclist in a black leather vest and a Captain America helmet, to name a few. On any day's lecture, you never knew what you're going to get. His style was a treasure. And in the spirit of the unexpected, I'm going to share with you one of Ted's greatest educational humor moments, which has lived on famously or infamously, depending on where you are on the spectrum of scatological versus just purely entertaining. And this is a Ted Vanita original classic entitled We Ain't Got No Weenie in the Brain. And if you'd like, it can be sung to the tune, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. But there's a point to this because it is incredibly scientifically based and factual. Oh, we ain't got no weenie in the brain. No, we ain't got no weenie in the brain. We got fingers, we got toes, we got a back, we got a nose. But we ain't got no weenie in the brain. Then a young man made an astounding claim that the textbooks indeed are all insane. If we've got fingers, we got toes, we got a back, we got a nose, then there must be a weenie in the brain. So great minds attacked this mystery. To this riddle, they looked for a key. They fussed and they fumed, but the mystery still loomed, for the weenie wasn't there for them to see. Then a scientist named Fred Vrasimilia cried, Eureka! I've found the genitalia! It's not near the head nor toes. It's not near the back nor nose. It's right there with all the other paraphernalia. So his colleagues all sang this little song to the scientist who looked both hard and long. If it's not near the head nor toes, if it's not near the back nor nose, you must tell us where the weenie does belong. He declared, it's quite simple, don't you know? But it's hidden where it isn't apt to show. It resides in the middle, so that if you have to piddle, you can use the foramen of Monroe. Dr. Seuss ain't got nothing on Ted. Humor was like a cloud that followed him, and his unconscious, unplanned humor was just as delicious. We may call these quirks or eccentricities, no matter. They were all part of the Ted that we all came to know and love. And his parsimony was legendary. Drinking the old departmental coffee Monday morning that was left in the pot from the previous Friday. Oh, would you like a cup of coffee? Or the ever famous lunchtime ask. You aren't going to eat that parsley, are you? As he ravenously made his move for your garnish like an alligator after a wayward chicken. Many of us have seen or heard of the Big Bang Theory, a long-running comedy that showcased a nerdy crew of physicists at Caltech who try with varying success to navigate life. One memorable episode was when they acquired the use of Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman's van, and then drove it into Baja for a road trip with disastrous results. In a twist on the phenomenon of life imitating art, one day I realized just how close this episode was to Ted's own life. Ted was fortunate to work with Roger Sperry at, yes, Caltech. and Sperry went on to be awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology. Interestingly, Ted had also met Richard Feynman at Caltech. After Sperry's death, Ted purchased Sperry's camper, which was a vintage pickup truck and camper combo that Sperry would use to explore and recreate in Baja. Hence, the Sperrymobile was born. Ted and Swanee would cruise Baja and California in this rolling artifact, complete with outrageously sized sand tires and held together in places with duct tape and wire. When they came to visit when I was training in San Diego in the late 90s, they parked the Sperrymobile in front of the house. The neighbors were so alarmed that they promptly called the police, after which I had some quiet explaining to do, along with my guarantee that Ted and Swanee were neither squatters nor illegals. One thing was certain. When you were with Ted, there was always a caper lurking. One more thing is certain. The loss of Ted leaves a hole in my life. Yes, Ted, with certainty, you will be missed. And I am thankful for every moment we shared together.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Bill Keck, and I want to thank Swanee for giving me an opportunity to reflect a little bit on the life of Ted. I actually first met Ted almost 60 years ago, because he was beginning his career at Case Western Reserve University as an assistant professor of neuroscience there, and I was a brand new medical student. So, you know, I was one student in a group of many, and he was one professor in a group of many. We didn't interact much, but we knew each other. And then we went our separate ways, or I sort of left and went off finishing training and traveling around Peace Corps, things like that, and then came back to Northeast Ohio and was hired as Akron's Director of Health and as a new professor of community health sciences at New UCOM in December of 1975. So I preceded Ted by a few months at least in being another one of the early professors at what is now NeoMed. Well, it was then that I sort of got reacquainted with Ted because we ended up seeing each other in faculty meetings, a fairly small faculty as we began. And as things continued, then I became chair of what was then a division of community health sciences. So Ted and I found ourselves in leadership meetings together. And I began to appreciate how this neuroscientist somehow had a strong streak of social justice. He kept asking me about public health stuff. There aren't many neuroscientists who ask me about public health stuff. And so I became a little bit intrigued, and as time went on, I began to understand better how broad Ted's interests were and how strong a social justice warrior he was. Well, it was in the 90s then when I became involved with the Cuban health system. I was on the board of a group called Medical Education Cooperation with Cuba. And I was traveling to Cuba regularly, legally, to learn more about their health system and to help bring students and professionals to Cuba. In my own way, I guess I was trying to break the embargo just a little bit. Well, Ted became intrigued and really wanted to know more about Cuba. And so occasionally, my wife Ardith and I would get together and we would take groups of professionals to Cuba to get a sense of what was there. Well, going to Cuba is not like going to most other Caribbean countries. After all, there's a great deal of enmity, if you haven't noticed, between Cuba and the U.S. And the embargo made things very difficult. Heaven forbid your cell phones don't work there. Your credit cards don't work there. So if you're going to travel to Cuba, to this somewhat unusual place, then there are a few rules that you had to think about before you went. So whenever we took a group, we would get them together ahead of time and describe to people what was important when you went to Cuba. First, you had to plan for not having a credit card. That meant you had to take cash. and enough to hold you for the time you'd be there. It meant that you had to overcome your fear of this strange place, which is really a beautiful, safe place to go. And you had to understand that you were going to be out of touch with your family and your professions for quite a while. So the day came and we went. I remember Ted was dressed in a light-colored sport jacket, I think, and we got on the plane, met in Miami, flew to Havana, got off the plane. Of course, it was hot. So Ted took off his sport coat and laid it over his arm, and we began the process of going through customs. It's a little scary the first time you're there because of all the stories about Cuba. And in Cuba, you go through security on the way in as well as the way out, because they don't want you bringing stuff in that they don't want there. So we tended as a group to get separated, and we had arranged that we would all meet outside once we got there. So we got outside, people began to come out, picked up their luggage, we gathered together, no Ted. Ted finally came out, he was the last one, and he was distraught because he had brought $500 with him in cash, in I think a leather wallet of some sort, and he lost it in the airport. And so we began the process of going back into the airport, gathering our colleagues and our hosts, and we explored that airport. And of course, there was no money to be found. So here was Ted in Cuba. His room and board and breakfast were prepaid, but anything else he would have to pay for himself. Now, fortunately, Ardith and I have been through this before, and so we always had a little extra cash with us. So I was able to assure Ted that, indeed, we would help him. But we learned our lesson. We said, Ted, here's $100, and when you use it, come get us, and we'll give you another 100, because we sure weren't going to give him $500 to lose all at once. There was a sort of absent-minded professor kind of sense about Ted, right? He wasn't always conscious of what was going on around him for some reason. And so I learned then also that I better watch Ted. And indeed, several times we were down in old Havana, crowds of people, came to a little park, it was a beautiful mural, and Ted got all excited and wanted to take a picture of it. Next thing I knew, he put all his stuff down on a park bench and ran off into the park. Well, you know, Cuba's a safe place, but it's a big city. I mean, you just... So I had to stand there and call out, I said, Ted! And he said, oh, yeah. But he ran, took the picture, and then he came back. And that was sort of the way it went. And so I began to really appreciate these other qualities of Ted, and certainly his sense of humor. He loved being pranked. He got pranked a few times by Glenn Salzman, where he had gotten an invitation, I think, to go to Hawaii for 3 months to teach, and his boss at the time got the word out that there was going to be a big farewell luncheon for Ted. And he made all these arrangements, got Ted to Kent State University in the student center with a big table set up, lots of places, Ted at one end, Glenn Salzman at the other. Nobody else showed up. And so Glenn had a few remarks. He had a note from a few people explaining why they couldn't come. So it was really all put on. Ted enjoyed it very much. And we enjoyed being with him all the time. You know, at times like this, it sort of brings to mind your own mortality and the short time we have on this planet, the time that's really too short to think about all the great problems and issues that evolve. And I have to tell you, whenever I think of Ted, I keep saying to myself, could it really be that we ain't got a weenie on the brain?
Hello, good morning. My name is Philip Westerman. I'm not on the program, but I was a colleague of Ted's, a friend, and a lunchtime companion. I had hundreds of lunches with Ted. And one aspect of Ted's character that hasn't been mentioned today is his competitiveness. And the food service at NeoMed introduced a salad bar, but they weren't very thoughtful in the rules. There was a small plate and a large plate. If you chose the small plate, you paid a certain amount of money. If you chose the large plate, there was an extra charge. They weren't going to weigh things. So Ted and I engaged in a competition. We wanted to see who could fit the most salad into the small container. So the piles got higher and higher as the days went by. They changed the system very shortly. They began weighing the salads. But Ted won that competition. So he was a competitive guy. Swanee called me and asked me if I would read a statement that the president of NeoMed put on the website, The Pulse, it's called the magazine. It's neomed.edu if you want to read the complete statement. But I'm going to read Dr. Langels, the president of NeoMed, I'm going to read what he wrote on the website. Much of this has been already said by Jeff and others. In July 1976, Dr. Benaida joined NeoMed, then known as NeoUCOM, as program chief and professor of neurobiology, becoming one of the first faculty hired. Dr. Benaida received MED and PhD degrees from Cornell University. He was a postdoctoral fellow in biology at the California Institute of Technology and a research fellow at the Institute of Neurophysiology and Psychophysiology in Marseille, France. He was also a professor in the departments of anatomy and biology at the Case Western Reserve College of Medicine before joining NeoMed. Dr. Benaida went on to develop and chair the Department of Neurobiology at NeoMed, one of the first in the country. The department now includes anatomy and neurobiology. As passionate about educating medical students as he was conducting research, Dr. Benaida left a legacy for basic science researchers at NeoMed, with whom teaching remains a huge part of their jobs. In the late 1970s, he responded to a request from area grade school science teachers who wanted their students to see what happens in labs on campus. There were some funny stories going around at Rootstown High School as to what we did in the labs. Students were invited to a morning study of the brain. The sessions were so successful that they grew to science days, which continue in various forms today as part of the university's pre-medical and pathway programs. In 1996, Dr. Benaida was among the first faculty to be named a master teacher. Dr. Benaida had a profound influence on the development of NeoUCOM as a medical school, combining an unbounded enthusiasm for teaching medical and graduate students with innovation in the development of one of the first departments of neurobiology in the US, said Jeff Wenstrop, PhD, Assistant Dean of Research as well as Professor and Chair of the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology. Dr. Benaida retired in December 1996 and was subsequently appointed Professor Emeritus in Neurobiology. His commitment and love of teaching is recognized by NeoMed's Ted Benaida Neuroscience Award for Outstanding Achievement in Medical Neuroscience. This year's prize was awarded Monday, January 6, 2020, to medical students Anna Katowski and Divya Sharma. Before accepting the position with NeoMed, Dr. Benaida informed university leadership of his social activism and his regular appearances on a weekly radio show called The Other View. His views were not always popular, and he was once banned by the National Institutes of Health. His work to combat the environmental effects of strip mining in southern Ohio was recognized by President Jimmy Carter in a White House ceremony. Dr. Vanida and his wife were recently honored by the creation of the Ted and Swanee Vanida Social Justice Award by the Universalist Unitarian Church of Kent Social Justice Council. I'm going to miss Ted a lot. I'm going to miss those lunches that we held. Thank you.
My name is Jeff Marsh, and I just wanted to, I feel like I'm here to speak for the generations of graduate students and of medical students who had the great fortune to work with Dr. Vanida. I was never able to bring myself to call him Ted. Dr. Vanida, I can clearly tell you, became one of my heroes in life. Starting off in med school, he was one of the first professors that we had the chance to meet. Neurobiology, neuroanatomy was a big part of our first year in 1984 when I started it at NeoUCOM. And as you would imagine, neuroanatomy, neurobiology can be kind of a dry topic. Learning various little pathways, trying to get this very complicated organ understood is very difficult. But Dr. Vanida had an amazing way of being able to make very complicated concepts very understandable. And he did so because of his very organized and very serious mind, but also with his high degree of humor that he brought into every experience. Groucho Marx was a constant member of our faculty that was able to create some levity when we were trying to grasp very difficult topics. By the end of our first year in neurobiology was a big part of our entire first year curriculum. It's not an exaggeration to say that there were a large number of us which were planning to become neurologists and neurosurgeons. Some of which who actually continued on research on that path. He made a big impact. He made learning fun. He made learning, especially the first year of medical school, which is incredibly difficult. You know, even after you've gone through an undergraduate science curriculum, trying to accumulate all the information that's part of a first year of medical school is just incredibly difficult and stressful. And Dr. Vanida did it with such grace and with such humor that it made it fun. And that was an important thing to get us all through to that point. A lot of us actually ended up going into some kind of neuroscience. In my class, there were a few neurologists, a few neurosurgeons, and actually I ended up doing neurocritical care for a large part of my career. That was all, I think, in large part due to Dr. Vanida. But that was just a small part of what he actually meant to me. Because what he did and what he brought to a medical school was the concept that we all were more than just one-dimensional beings. We all were more than just science. That being part of our community, being an active part of our community, was really crucial. Prior to that time, as a 20-year-old, I'd had a relatively sheltered life, especially from a social active environment. I'd never gone to a protest. I'd never really met anybody very famous up until that time. Dr. Vanida, one of the most crucial parts of my medical school time was he brought his friend to us, one of our special human values and medicine programs. And that friend was Benjamin Spock. And Benjamin Spock, I found out, was a colleague and a very good friend of Dr. Vanida's going back to Case Western Reserve. And I expected to go to a lecture of hearing how babies were developed and how to become an obstetrician, because that's kind of what I was thinking about being back in that time. What I found out was that Dr. Spock and Dr. Vanida raised a bit of cane back in the day. They were very, very active in the anti-war movement. And that friendship, that camaraderie really carried through up until the time that he had brought his friend back to inspire a new generation of medical students. It opened my doors to my eyes to who Dr. Vinita was. He was not just the neuroscientist who was able to really crack jokes while teaching complex information. He was somebody who was really somebody to aspire to. And he really truly became one of my heroes at that time. I finished up med school. I enjoyed my time. I had very good memories of the time with all of the professors, particularly with Dr. Vinita, and I went on my way. And during that course of my training, I ended up becoming an intensive care physician and actually had a subspecialty in neurocritical care, I think in large part because of that foundation in medicine that he was able to provide me. And really didn't think much of it. I had fond memories of med school, fond memories of Dr. Vinita. But then my situation changed, and I came back to Ohio. I had been in New York and in Pennsylvania for a long period of time. Came back to Ohio. During that period of time I was away, I discovered Unitarian Universalism and felt that it really resonated with me as an individual. And when we moved back to Northeast Ohio, I was looking around at the various options for coming congregations to attend. And lo and behold, the website of the Universalist Unitarian Congregation of Kent, there's Dr. Vinita. And I couldn't have been more thrilled. I saw that this was definitely the place for me to return to. When I came back and saw him in the choir, in the front row, being able to be part of a community, it was just inspiring to see someone who even later into life, when other people were out in the golf course or out doing things that weren't maybe serious, he continues to be engaged. He continued to be engaged with his activism in all different kinds of ways. And he continued to be the same humorous and genuine person that I remembered well from med school. It was also important for me to see someone who continued to be inspired and to inspire me to be attentive to family, because he clearly had great love for the family that was part of his that was close to his part of his circle. He was devoted to his community, and he was definitely devoted to his humor, and that stayed right up until the very, very end. Even as his body was failing and his mind was becoming ravaged, he had a smile, he had a laugh that was infectious and was definitely something that we all could appreciate. So it was a great honor to know Dr. Vinita, and he'll always be my hero.
We'll continue with our remembrances as we hear from some of Ted's family.
Ted Vinita has been my lover, my best friend, wonderful father, and companion for 65 years. I will miss him so much. We did everything together, fighting the good fights, having fun, and so much else. Now I would like to tell you about the last week of his life. It started with a Christmas party at Mulberry Gardens Memory Care Facility. Ted, Audrey, and I went along with the other residents and their families. They had an excellent band playing Christmas carols. Ted loved to sing with his deep, resonant voice. Audrey and I joined him, as well as many others. Ted was having a great time. He ate all the sweets he could stuff in and all the eggnog, unspiked, he noted, that he could hold. He had a blast. That night, he could not sleep because he was so hyped up. The next day, he was exhausted, but answering us in coherent sentences. Later, his answers were short, but always made sense, right up until midnight, Saturday, when everyone left but me. They brought in a small couch for me to rest on. He frequently moved or was restless, but when I spoke to him, he quieted. 2 hours later, on Sunday morning, he passed away peacefully with no pain. It was a good death, they say, as they like to say, yes. It was a fitting end for a man who lived his life to the fullest and tried his best to leave this world in better shape. Well, now you've heard a lot about Ted's humor. He had a great sense of humor. But he also could be rather devilish with his humor. Ted did his undergraduate degree in physical therapy at Ithaca College, New York. As part of his training, he did a volunteer experience at the United Cerebral Palsy Center there. He told me about some of the experiences that he had working with the kids there. The students were at the facility during the week and went home with their parents on weekends. One sunny day, Ted and a tall teenage boy he knew went out for a walk. This kid wore heavy steel braces from the waist down so that he could walk. He also used Canadian crutches, which fit around the forearm fit around the forearm. They were walking along, and one of them told the other a joke, which they loved to do. They both got to laughing like crazy, and the boy threw his crutches out on each side onto the grass. Ted had to hold the boy up with his arms around his waist as they both continued laughing. Behind them, a man in a black top hat and suit and tie was walking towards them. He eyed them strangely and moved slowly, not knowing quite what to do. Ted said, laughing, "Sir, could you hand us our crutches?" The gentleman walked out on the grass on each side and handed Ted each crutch gingerly by the end so it could just reach Ted. Then the gentleman hurried on his way, first being sure that Ted and the boy were okay. Well, that's kind of a prelude to what I'm going to say. Persons with cerebral palsy have quite a bit of spasticity in their arms and legs. Now there are many therapies to ameliorate this, thank goodness. In their arms and hands, this can result in what is termed a claw hand. You try it. Put your hand like this, tight hand. Ted was good at imitating this, but always in fun, never at anyone's expense. Well, this is to prepare you for what Ted pulled on our poor daughter, Dorianne. Dorianne was about 16 years old and dating several nice boys, but not serious about any of them. Then she talked about Mark, who she said played the violin. He lived not far away and knew many of her friends. She told us he was coming to pick her up for their first date at the house. The doorbell rang and we three went to the door. Ted opened the door to see a good-looking kid who was smiling. But Mark put out his hand to shake his hand. But Ted, who instead of giving him a regular handshake, made his hand into a claw hand like this. Mark looked at him with eyes of surprise. Then he forced himself to say something. Then they both broke out laughing. What does a violinist with some years of practice value highly? His hands. This was Ted's joke, and Mark caught on immediately. Dorianne and I looked on in horror, of course. Then we burst out laughing, too. Mark was a really nice guy and was a good musician, But after a while, they both went on their way. So far as I know, Dorian never told anyone about this, not even her husband, Ralph. I hope Ted is laughing somewhere about his joke, but I don't think that Dorian is. Thank you.